I was with Dad and it was very early morning and he was in the hover in the Bell 47 and this rabbit shot out from the parking cones. My dad's like, let's get him. So he started mustering this rabbit a foot off the ground in the morning dew, and this rabbit zigzagging, we're zigzagging, and then all of a sudden Dad's like, all right, we have enough energy, throws out a translational lift, and then up we go.
Welcome aboard the High Fly Media podcast, dedicated to sharing the stories and experiences of the amazing people who make aviation happen. From pilots like me, to engineers, air traffic controllers and others, I'll explore their personal journeys, the challenges they've faced and the triumphs they've achieved. My name is Damien and I'll be your host. Whether you're a seasoned aviation enthusiast or new to the field, I invite you to join me as we take off on this journey of discovery. Welcome, aviation enthusiasts, to another exciting episode of the High Fly Media podcast. Today, we're thrilled to soar to new heights as we delve into the remarkable journey of Michaela Reaper, breaking barriers as Jetstar's youngest ever female captain at the age of 28. In this episode, we uncover the story of a passionate aviator whose dreams took flight early on, fueled by a family deeply rooted in the world of aviation. Join us as we explore Michaela's inspiring ascent from first officer in 2016 to commanding Jetstar's A320 aircraft, all while shattering stereotypes and inspiring the next generation of aviators. Welcome, Michaela.
Hello, hello.
It's good to have you on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I've got to tell you, the reason you're on the podcast is actually because of my mother. I owe it all to her.
Oh, really?
Yeah, she came across a magazine article from a magazine from South Australia and she messaged it to me and said, you might want to have a chat to this young lady if you can. So that's where it all came from.
I didn't even know I was in a magazine. So that's cool to hear.
I can send you the link after the podcast recording.
That would be awesome.
Yeah, there you go. And I noticed you've had various interviews. I think Channel 7 interviewed you at some point.
Yes. Yeah, so that was probably my first and what I thought to be my only media discussions.
Engagement.
Yes. And that was actually teed up many months ago when I got allocated my command slot. I got an email from the Jetstar's media team asking if I'd be happy to do that. And I said, oh, can we wait until I've passed my training first? So I did all of that within my first week after passing my command test, my flight test.
Yeah.
So it was very cool to do. And it was very fortunate that I was able to have my husband Pablo there as well.
That is very cool.
So that was very cool.
Yeah. So what I read in the article is that he's also a pilot with Jetstar. Is that correct?
That is correct. Yeah. He's a first officer for Jetstar and he started last year with Jetstar. Of course, he's been flying way longer than that, but into Jetstar this year.
So I have to ask the obvious question. Have you flown together in the A320 yet?
Not yet. We're waiting for it. Totally fine to fly together. We've passed our initial, because they don't have, they don't allow green on green to fly. So can't have two newbies flying together, which is totally fair enough. And I 100% agree with it. So me being a new captain, he being a new FO, we have to wait, I think, 3 months for him to do his follow-up. And then he's now unrestricted, so he can fly with restricted captains like myself.
Right.
And I'll be restricted for 6 months and I'm halfway there. And then I'll be able to fly with everyone.
So it's just a matter of time then.
That's it. That's exactly right. So I'm very excited when that happens.
Well, especially if you're both flying out of the same base, I imagine it. Like it literally will be just a matter of time.
Yeah, we'll probably be just on a standby call out or something. Yeah. Simple as that, hopefully.
That's cool. You see plenty. There's a few photos and I've got a friend who's a captain. I want to say Virgin. I'm pretty sure he's a captain with Virgin. And his son is a fairly fresh FO.
That's awesome.
And they've flown together and that was a cool
photo
to see. Yeah, very cool.
I love the family ties. We've got a few husband-wife pairings in Jetstar as well. There's at least three that I can think of and they've all flown together, so it's very exciting.
Yeah, right. So tell me, in the intro I mentioned that you've got a family history in aviation. Do you want to unpack that for us and maybe unpack where the light bulb or where the you caught the bug?
Well, I think I can't get a definitive moment when I caught the bug. My parents both fly helicopters. They ran a helicopter training school on the Sunshine Coast. So I actually grew up around helicopters. I used to earn my pocket money, actually, cleaning bubbles. So the windscreens, they call them bubbles on helicopters.
Yeah.
On Friday afternoons, I get my pocket money for cleaning a helicopter bubble. So that was just part of my childhood. And then I think as I got older, I realized that I could actually do that as well. Mm. And then I actually remember when the 380 came out and I was super inspired by that. And it sort of probably clicked that I wanted to fly an Airbus. So I think that's why I switched from helicopters to planes. Otherwise, I'd probably be flying helicopters.
So did you start in helicopters?
So I have flown helicopters, but I don't have a license. Obviously, with my parents flying helicopters, I was very lucky to get a few joyrides, join them on some sorties and things like that. Right. So I've probably flown in more helicopters types than most people would. But it was just so awesome. Like, I think there's something special about helicopters. I'd love to get my license one day.
Yeah.
But I don't know. The bug for planes, I think, and airline flying was was strong.
Too strong. Yeah, okay. Right. So it's interesting you mentioned about Airbus. There's a chap that I interviewed in one of the earlier podcasts, Josh Villani. He flies the A321, I want to say, out of Las Vegas. He's an Australian. He's from the Sunshine Coast.
Oh,
he was from
it's just sunny coast, man.
A bit so further good. South than where you grew up on the sunny coast. I won't say where he's from because I don't want people trying to stalk him.
Yep, fair enough.
But so he's flying the 321 now out of Vegas for Frontier Airlines, and he was just saying,
very cool.
He loves the Airbus. He loves the airframe. He loves the technology. And yeah, that's his.
Airbus is amazing. Mm. Yep. So I can actually fly the 320, 321, and then Jetstar has the brand new 321 Neo. They're all a similar type.
Ah.
So it's very cool.
That is really cool. And so obviously you say your parents have a helicopter. Were they just charter or were they instructing as well?
Instructing. So they did a lot of military type contracts where they teach people how to fly helicopters in formation and low level flying and really cool, fun stuff like that.
Yeah.
And my grandpa actually, he was in aviation too. He had a helicopter charter business I think it was Singapore. I should really know this. I just know that it was in that region.
Right.
And then my uncle, God bless his soul, he was an engineer. So my whole family is sort of involved.
You had no chance.
No chance, that's right.
And then what did your flight training look like then when it comes to, you know, being inspired by your family, but around rotary wing to then eventually ending up in very large fixed wing? What's that journey look like?
Well, I think to start with, my parents wanted to make sure I actually wanted to do it. So I did a couple of hours in a Zenith of all things, on the Sunshine Coast, just like a little two-seater to really see if I wanted to do that. And that was during high school. And I'm like, yes, mom, yes, dad, this is totally the gig. And they're like, okay, well, now you need to finish high school, you know, got to do your maths and some sort of STEM, so like physics or chemistry. I ended up doing physics.
Good choice.
And then, physics is good. and then I got into the Jetstar cadetship. And that was the way to do it. I think it's the fastest way, but you have to, it's very competitive, or at least back then. I don't know what it's like now, but back then it was very, very competitive. I didn't actually get in the first time.
Right.
They said, your group skills are really good. Your pilot is good, but of all things, my long math. So division, multiplication, because you know, you use a calculator in school.
Yeah.
They're like, come back though. So for 3 months, I just practiced manual math. Yep. And I blitzed it the second time. And they actually had to delay my start because I was 17 when I got in and you're not allowed to start till you're 18.
Holy cow.
Yep. So wait a few more months. And then, it's pretty intense. It took 14 months. So I actually learned how to fly in New Zealand.
Okay.
Yeah, Hamilton, New Zealand, the CTC. That was the cadet program back then.
Right.
And that's, you get your PPL, your CPL, your multi-engine command rating, instrument rating, I should say. And I flew a Katana, a DA-20, little two-seater, and then the DA-42.
Nice. So all diamond aircraft then over there.
All diamond. We did get a go in a Cessna and there was an aerobatic plane that I can't quite remember. I can't remember the name of it because we only did it once just to tick the spinning box, I think.
Yeah, right.
Yep. But then, Jetstar Cadetship, they give you the opportunity to have a job with them. So they give you the job once you've passed. But at the time, they didn't need any cadets. They didn't need any pilots. I actually had 2 years wait before since I finished my cadetship to then starting with Jetstar. I came back to the Sunny Coast and I actually did my instructor rating, got my ATPL subjects. I did some charter stuff in a Duchess. It was all very cool. And they called me like on a Friday and like, oh, hey, are you able to get to the UK on Monday for your type rating on the 320? And I'm like, yeah, I can do that. Yep. And I still remember arriving like Sunday night and then sleeping and then being in class with the rest of my course mates who also did the cadetship with me. We'd all flown in at various times and were there at 9 a.m. on Monday and we were just drooling because they're still jet lagged. Yeah. And we're like, we're here, we made it. Like,
amped on caffeine.
Yeah, honestly.
So you get a call on Friday afternoon and then I assume, you'd been in New Zealand, so you already had a passport. So then it was just finding a seat on a plane to get to England.
Yeah, and they book all that for you. Realistically, we'd been having, you know, emails and stuff a couple of weeks prior, like, oh, we don't have the dates. And then they call up, all right, this is when you either say yes or you say no. This is like the point.
Yeah.
So, but that's how every airline works. It's when they're short of pilots. And yeah, I mean, this is sort of unprecedented. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Like, so that was fun. I mean, you know, do the type rating. And then that took 3 months in the UK and then came back to Australia. And then you do your line training with Jetstar, and the training department in Jetstar is unparalleled. They're amazing. And they've really improved in the last couple of years. I think we're one of the first airlines to have EBT, which is evidence-based training. And it's amazing. It's amazing. I can't wait for other airlines to adopt it.
Do you want to unpack that a bit for the listeners?
Absolutely. So evidence-based training is I guess rewinding to the old system, every year you would do two sim cyclics. So you go into the simulator over 2 days, 4 hours a day, testing your emergency procedures or your standard stuff. And in the old days, it used to be like really stressful, but also in the way that you sort of knew what was coming. There was a bit of a script. So like, okay, at some point I'm going to get an engine failure here, or I might get a rejected takeoff or whatever. These days, evidence-based training is they just say, right, you're flying from here to here. That's all we're going to tell you.
Oh, wow.
So it's sort of way better in terms of training. It's positive training because in the end, you have to treat it like a real thing. And it's not just like, okay, yep, now I'm going to get an engine failure. It's like, no, at any point during this session, you could have any failure. So it's a bit more inclusive, wholesome. I think we're way better pilots for it.
That's awesome. You mentioned an airframe there that no one else other than, I don't know anyone else that's flown a Duchess other than myself and the instructors that I did my instrument rating with. Yeah. What did you?
They're pretty old.
I was going to say, how did you find it?
How did I find it? As in enjoying it?
Yeah.
Yes. Well, I love the Duchy. Yeah. I think that's because that was really the first multi-engine that I got to fly whilst being paid. So under my commercial license and I flew it to some really cool places. I loved it. I don't know. It was just, it's such an old clunky thing, but also you sort of get to love it and you know it's secrets because I flew the one rego, so I wasn't swapping between them all. So we affectionately called this one Kate the Duchess after Kate and William.
Okay.
But yeah, no, I love the Duchy. It's very good.
Yeah. Okay. So you got endorsed and then you came back to Australia and you've been in and getting line checked. And I read in the intro that you became a first officer in 2016.
That's correct. I was 21.
Do you remember your first, we'll call it paid, airline flight as an FO?
Absolutely, I do. It was from Melbourne to Sydney. It was at night and it was raining so much. And my parents were on board and Pablo was also on board. He wasn't my husband back then.
Yeah.
We'd been together for a few years, but they didn't tell me that they were on board. I only found out once we landed it was Melbourne to Sydney. Once we landed in Sydney and I went out to go do the walk around.
Yeah.
And you just say goodbye to some passengers and stuff sometimes. And then I'm like, they're all in row one, just sitting there. And I'm like, guys, what? So they were there the whole time. So it was a really sweet moment. And they all got off, obviously, and we ended up going back to there at the end of the night. So, you know, got to hang out and stuff. So that was really sweet. I definitely remember that flight. It was really cool.
So you you left Sydney and then ended up coming back to Sydney.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, right.
So I think it was a four sector. I can't quite remember. I know it was between Melbourne and Sydney. It might have been Melbourne to Sydney or Sydney to Melbourne.
Yeah.
one of those places.
Yeah.
But you finish at the end of the night after four sectors or whatever it was, and then they were all at a hotel and we'd stay at a hotel that night.
That's really special.
Living there yet. It was special.
It's really special. What a surprise. And to think that they orchestrated all that without you knowing.
Well, they also orchestrated it again for my command check.
Oh.
And they were very naughty because I asked them not to. But on my last flight, because you do 2 days, and the last day on the last sector, I was flying from the Sunshine Coast to Sydney. And, of course, my parents live in the Sunshine Coast.
Yeah.
So they were on that flight as well. And, again, I didn't know until I'd opened the door at the end and I had my four bars on at that point because I'd passed and they'd given me the four bars, shook the hand, all that. So that was really special as well.
That's so cool.
Yeah. Were they my husband was in the terminal. He was waving as we were parking the plane.
you got stitched up. But why wouldn't they share that? Why wouldn't they share that?
It is such a good moment. I asked them not to just because it's so stressful, you know, but you can't curb the parents. They got to do what they got to do.
Totally. But you didn't know. So, you know.
No, that's right. So that's probably the good thing.
At least they played that game. So as far as, you've jumped through so many hoops. Like, I don't even know where to begin. The endorsement in the UK over 3 months must have been a heck of a challenge and cramming all of that into such a tight time frame. And then, well, even, you know, you mentioned that after you did the initial training in New Zealand, you came back and you did your ATPLs.
Yep.
So there's a massive study load.
Yeah, that I did that full time. And I want to say that my parents have been super supportive through all of it. So without them, I wouldn't be here. Because you sort of the financial aspect of learning to fly is extremely heavy and it's very difficult. So for 6 months, I studied the ATPLs, that's a lot of study, full time study, and no one passes all of them first time. If you do, well done, but I certainly didn't. So I had to do a few repeats, but that's part of all the learning and stuff. And really, those ATPL subjects are sort of tailored towards airline pilots, of course, and I hadn't flown an airline. Most people who sit those tests don't fly in an airline. So they're really, really hard. They're really difficult. So at the time, it was very good. But it's just study.
Yeah, information. And from memory, I think the ATPLs are based off like a 727 or something, like all the performance. Yes. It's not even an airline you're probably ever going to fly.
No, I don't think anyone will fly that in Australia. So I think, systems is a 767 and then the rest of it is the 727. I've still got the big chunky blue book to, you know, look up all the graphs.
Did you do that through Advanced Flight Theory or did you self-study your ATPL?
No, I did it with Nathan Higgins. Yeah. Yep, AFT. They're so good.
Bit of a legend in that field.
He is. Yeah, he's been there for many, many years. I think many people wouldn't be able to pass ATPL subjects without his guidance. Mm. He's very good.
With your journey and taking into account your flight training in New Zealand.
Yep.
Your instrument rating, your air transport pilot license subjects, the endorsement in the UK, and then coming back and doing your, I'm assuming there would have been a lot of study around standard operating procedures and whatnot for Jetstar.
Absolutely.
I would be ignorant if I didn't think there was challenges along the way because at the end of the day, you're human, I believe. Mm-hmm. What were some of those? What did you find your major hurdles were and how did you get through them?
Well, I think for in that early aviation sense, so when you're just starting out and you're getting a PPL, CPL, multi, you know, you're doing all that study, it's just about discipline, getting those study habits, you know, like most people are definitely capable of completing those things if they have that sort of discipline and guidance and, you know, you have some goals set. Failure is part of it. If you manage to pass everything first time, I actually find you're not as good of a pilot later because you'll have a failure later on. You think you're invincible at that point, or at least I've seen that with others. Mm-hmm. And I think failing sort of early and understanding how to deal personally with failure, I mean, accepting that, I wasn't good enough and don't pretend like it didn't happen. It's like, so I need to improve on something. So I think the challenges of the self-development is probably what I found to be the most engaging, because the study side of it, anyone can do with discipline, but not many people can learn to understand themselves, what their resilience is, what they need for their own mental health and well-being to keep going with something. Mm-hmm. So that's taken me years and years to learn, I think. That wasn't an overnight thing. What other challenges? I think, so it's all that discipline at the beginning of your career. And when you get into multi-crew environments, you're pretty proficient at that point. If you've gotten an airline gig, you are pretty good at reading SOPs and understanding what must be done. Now it's people. You have to get along with one other person, or for the international, two or three, in the flight deck for an entire day. You may or may not see the cabin crew. And being a first officer, I think, is actually one of the harder jobs, because you've got to mold to the captain for the day, right, what they like, because there's a thousand ways to skin a cat. Yeah. There's a lot of different ways to follow SOPs and be proficient in your job. So I think as a first officer, I struggled a little bit to start with all the people, and making sure that I was following the SOPs and that they were following SOPs and we all got along. And yeah, I think.
And that would be,
that sums it up.
You know, I assume that you'd be potentially flying with captains that you've never met before.
Oh, absolutely. Every
first
day.
First time you meet on the flight deck.
Yep. Yeah. And also, another sort of added thing, some of them are double, almost triple my age when I started at 21. So I was quite young to be in that position. And I don't really want to mention it, but yet also the female thing. It does make a little bit of a difference. I don't like to use that as an excuse, because it's each for their own. But definitely the age probably came into play a bit more, because originally, to get into an airline, and still these days a little bit, cadetships weren't really a thing. They're very new. Well, at least the Jetstar one is. So that's sort of, you know, very young female. I'm here flying a jet. Not much experience, you know, you just got to prove yourself, keep the discipline, the study up.
And yeah.
It all comes through in the end.
Yeah, for sure.
And I don't get too worked up about it, because the best thing I can do is go to work, do my job, go home.
Exactly.
Yeah. And show everyone that that's exactly what everyone else has been doing. That's exactly what we want to do. All we want to do is go to work, do our job, come home. Good day.
Be safe in everything you do.
That's right.
So you recently received your command on the 320. Congratulations for that. Such an epic milestone. Do you still have aspirations to fly the big brother, the 380?
Oh, I think that would require changing airlines. So probably not at this stage, just how seniority works in airlines and things. Yep. You get given a number when you start, and that determines a lot of things, like the fleet and rank and pay and leave. So yeah. I think I'm pretty dedicated to Jetstar now, but for a long time the 380 was definitely a big goal. I mean, it's massive aircraft.
Oh,
but
yeah.
The 320, the little sister, is quite nice to fly as well.
Yeah, but, well, and that's what, you know, Josh talked about. He loved it. He loves it, and he loves the 321. Could you see yourself changing brands and flying the 787 internationally for Jetstar, or do you think you're more of a domestic, a homebody?
Well, I actually fly internationally as well on the 320.
Oh, really?
Yes. So Jetstar's got like a mixed fleet operation. So we do international and domestic.
That's right. You do Bali and whatnot in the 320.
That's right. I used to do Bali like twice a month for 7 years out of Adelaide, because we do a lot of Bali's out of there.
Right.
But out of Sydney, we also fly to Rarotonga and to Nandi, of course Bali, and I think New Zealand, although I haven't done one of those yet in a 320. So I do international and domestic already. So I think changing to only international, I would miss those short domestic hops. Yeah. The flying's a bit more intriguing. Yep. You go to various airports around the network. It's something different every single day.
That's cool. Yeah, very cool. So what are your goals and aspirations?
Oh, I think just to survive the year would be a good start. It's very stressful in your first year of command, because there's so much settling in.
Yeah.
But my biggest goal, of course, always was to be a captain, and to have achieved that is just amazing.
Especially so young.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think of it as being young. Like, I've always been in pursuit of this goal since I was 17 when I got into the cadetship. So for me, it was just like the natural progression of things. And then I realized that that's not normal for most people to get to this stage this young. So I'm very proud of myself. I'm very happy to be here. But I think for the next aspirations, I would love to do maybe be a training captain one day.
Yeah.
That would be very, very cool. They do have the opportunity at Jetstar where you train the new pilots that come in on
that
the 320.
That would be awesome.
Oh, I would love that. That'd be amazing. But I need some more experience as captain first.
Yeah, of course. maybe by your 30th birthday, you'll have that one under your belt.
Maybe, I don't know. So, yeah, I think training captain would be amazing. Maybe type rating instructor, where you teach people their type rating on the 320. Because that was a very cool experience in the UK. And I think they teach now in Australia as well. So I wouldn't have to go overseas to teach either. But that's a long way off. I'd say at least a minimum 3 or 4 years, I'd say.
Yeah, that's still in the fairly near future, though, when you think about it.
Yeah.
What kind of, well, let's take the check-in training captain, for example. What kind of hoops will you need to jump through to be able to, apart from experience, to be able to do that?
Well, I think you have to have a very good track record. So I was talking about the sim cyclics before. We do 2 a year. We also do a line check once a year. I would say there's 5 tests a year in an airline. You got your medical, you got your line check, your 2 sim cyclics, and then there's something called EPs, called emergency procedures. And that's where us as pilots will join the cabin crew for the day and go through all of their procedures and the equipment and how to evacuate via a slide.
Yeah,
and
okay.
So 5 tests a year. So you have to have a good track record with all of that year on year.
Yep.
You have to have a good rapport with everyone, high professional standards, good discipline and everything. And then if and when Jetstar needs some more training captains, they release, like, basically, hey, we need some. Who would like this? And it's on a merit-based system.
Right.
So you'd have to do an interview and some tests and things. But yeah, so that's as much as I know. I haven't really looked too much into it yet, but that's as far as I'm aware.
Well, one step at a time. I mean,
that's right.
Like you say, you've got a lot on your plate in the left-hand seat of a 320 at the moment.
That's right. Yeah. It's very fun though, but yes.
What's your favourite route to fly in Australia?
Oh, that's such a hard question.
And I'll bracket that with why. What makes it your favourite route?
I think I'm very biased. I was based in Adelaide for 7 years and I went back to Adelaide for the first time in about 2 months. And I think that runway is the most perfect runway to land on in Australia because it's flat. So some runways have like a dip in it.
Yeah.
So it makes it a bit frustrating to land on. It's a very standard width and length. It's very flat everywhere. And if you're landing in direction of 2-3, so magnetic direction 2-3-0, you're looking out of the ocean.
Beautiful.
You've got the perfect flare perspective. So I think Sydney, Adelaide, it's a longish flight, you know, like 1.5 hours. So you can have some lunch on the way. Not too stressful.
Yeah.
I think because I flew there for so long, it's probably my favorite at the moment. But Bali's always good.
Yeah.
Bali's always good on a really, really clear day when there's not many clouds, you can see the mountains. And we don't have many mountains in Australia. So when you go over to Indonesia and the mountains are 13,000 feet or higher, you actually just get that appreciation of Mother Nature, I guess, when you're coming in.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
The other question that popped into my mind beforehand was, do you recall your first landing as an FO when the captain said, right, you got it?
Yes. It was into Perth. We were going Melbourne-Perth, so it was a very long flight. And I guess the problem with long flights like that is you think about it too much. You're like, I got to land at the end.
Oh, so you knew from the start.
Yes, because you get allocated your you get allocated your sectors, or the captain decides at the beginning of the day or maybe just before the sector, like, oh, okay, you can fly this sector. So you'll do the takeoff, you'll organize the cruise and you'll do the descent and landing, and then you might switch. So then the captain will do a takeoff.
Yeah.
And et cetera. And at Jetstar, we're pretty even. We take turns, captains and FOs. So on that sector, the captain's like, that's yours. I'm like, okay.
Cool.
And there were so many parallels because when I did my first solo flight in New Zealand, I had 8 knots crosswind. And when I did my first landing in the 320, I had 8 knots crosswind.
Mm.
So I just always remember that because I'm like, oh, 8 knots, I can do that. That's fine. that's fine. And it was a good landing. So I was pretty pleased with it, but in Perth. Yep.
That's awesome. I remember Josh talking about just being conscious of the people that were sitting behind him. So that weighed on his mind a fair bit, in those first few days.
Yeah, I think it takes a bit to get that out of your head. And I think we never truly forget they are there, but we have a different perspective on it. It's like we can't let knowing that they're back there affect our ability to make adequate decisions for the day.
100%.
You know, you can't think, oh, but they want to get to their destination, or, you know, this, that. No, you got to do what's best for the day. You know, if you have to divert your weather or a mechanical issue, it's like, it is what it is. Safest option is this. And I know it's really bad for the passengers in the back. They might miss their flights or et cetera. And we do absolutely have sympathy for that. We like to get to our destination as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think you learn to just put them in the back of your mind and make the correct decisions and things.
Yeah, cool. Good to know that that's what's happening up front.
It wants to happen up front, right?
Yeah, that's right. I remember, you know, someone would say, hey, Damien, can we go for a fly? And be like, yeah, no worries. And they're like, oh, you know, please don't crash. And I was like, dude, I got 5 kids.
Wow.
I want to get home. I want to not crash more than you don't want me to crash.
That's right. I think pilots that have a healthy self-preservation, it's good. That's a good thing.
So after your line check where Mum and Dad were on the plane unknowingly.
And Pablo as well.
Yes.
Oh, sorry, was this for the command or my first officer?
No, command.
They're all for both. Yes, Pablo was in the terminal, that's right.
I was going to ask then after that flight check, that check flight, what was your first leg just with you and the FO in the aircraft?
Oh, man. So I planned it really well. I managed to get a couple of days off after that. So I had 3 days off. And it's a bit complicated how it works. So that was out of Sydney, but I was still officially Adelaide-based at the time. So all my flying was then going to be out of Adelaide. So I flew back to Adelaide. And my first flight was ironically my favorite route, Adelaide-Sydney, Sydney-Adelaide. and that was a 5:20 sign-on, and it was with an FO who I'd only met briefly once or twice in the crew room, a really lovely guy. And I remember saying to him, like, hey, this is day one for me. And he's like, oh, awesome. And I'm like, I'm glad you think it's awesome. We had a really good day and it was beautiful weather. And I think I just did what you got to do. I think when you shut that cockpit door as well, you just take a deep breath. You're like, you got this. It's fine.
Yeah.
I'm here.
Well, you've trained for it. You've trained for it, you know.
That's all right.
And at the end of the day, you're not going to get a command if you're not capable.
That's what you got to think to yourself, hey, because I think everyone will struggle with imposter syndrome at some point. I think if you don't struggle with imposter syndrome, then you're probably not like developing yourself enough. You've always got to think, how can I do better? How can I improve? You know, so that's, I think that's very normal, and being able to quell it, be like, no, I'm allowed to be here. I've done the work. I've done the training. And then you just do your job and it's all good.
Yeah. And then you've got plenty of water under the bridge.
Yeah.
Before I roll into the final questions, was there anything you wanted to talk about specifically?
Oh, that's a good question. I think I really just like to stress that anyone can fly a plane if they want. I know financially it's very hard to get into, and barring that financial struggle for that, I think personally everyone has it in them if they have enough self-development, always constantly learning and thinking that they can improve, and all the discipline and things I've been talking about, I truly believe everyone can make it.
Kind of goes without saying, but I think for some people it's very hard to fathom that, and probably because aviation's been such a difficult goal, such a difficult area, or such a difficult profession for people to get into for so many years, and it still is. I recorded in episode 3, Paul Strike. He said if it was easy, everyone would be doing it.
Absolutely.
It is hard to do, but it is very possible.
It's absolutely possible. And I think many people go into it with this idolized view of it, because it's been very romanticized.
Yeah,
you know, we get to travel and, you know, we make apparently lots of money. And I mean, we make pretty good money, but it takes a long time to get there and it's expensive to get to that point, and you get to wear the good uniform and stuff. So the romantic publicized side of it gets you hooked, but then you realize you've got to do hard work, and that's what people unhook.
Yes.
And they go, that's not what I expected. I thought this was going to be easier. So I think having a realistic expectation that you will find out things about yourself you didn't know about, you will fail something. You can't go 60 years in a career without failing something.
No.
It's how you come back from that. It's how you set your discipline. Don't get complacent. This industry has killed a lot of people. Every single rule that we have is most likely because someone's hurt themselves or killed themselves doing it. So I do think about that a lot. It's like we have this for a reason. Yeah, someone's probably hurt themselves or injured themselves at some point.
Yes, 100%. And you only need to watch a number of air crash investigation episodes to get that. Yeah. Okay, Michaela, I'll hit you with these rapid-fire questions, and I'm really interested to hear what your answer is for the third question, but we'll get through one and two first. Can you tell us about a memorable experience you had flying a particular aircraft and what made it special to you?
Oh, that's a really good question. I would have to say, and I myself wasn't actually flying the aircraft. It was a Bell 47, which people would know as the MASH helicopter.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, so the big round bubble.
Yeah.
So my parents had a company and they had a lot of helicopters, and they were going to an air show with the Bell 47 and a couple of their other helicopters, so Bell 206s, mm-hmm. which are jet rangers, and we were flying in formation up to Toowoomba, and I was sitting with Dad in – we call him Oscar. His name is Oscar, the Bell 47. He's bright, bright yellow. And we flew in formation all the way to Toowoomba. And then he used to give joyrides to Vietnam veterans, actually, in the Bell 47.
Yeah.
And we stayed the night. And then the next day when we were flying home, it was another formation home. And I was with Dad, and it was very early morning. And he was in the hover in the Bell 47. All the other helicopters were on the other side of the airfield, different parking. And this rabbit shot out from the parking cones, those little triangle parking cones. My dad's like, let's get him. So he started mustering this rabbit like a foot off the ground in the morning dew, and this rabbit zigzagging, we're zigzagging. And then all of a sudden dad's like, all right, we have enough energy. Here's our translational lift. And then up we go. That's and meet awesome. The other helicopters. That's I so think cool. I will never forget that.
Was that heading up to like the David Hack Day or something?
I can't quite remember. I was very young. I think it was only...
Was it like a Warbirds Day?
Yeah, I think it was, because there was a lot of Vietnam vets and we gave them all a joyride, and they actually remember flying. There was one in particular I remember flew that actual SN, the serial number, Oscar himself in Vietnam. So he was like tearing up because he'd come back and he'd found this helicopter again. So that was a very special moment.
That is very special. Can you tell us one of your fear-filled flight experiences?
I'm not sure if people will believe me, but I don't think I've ever truly been scared whilst flying. Stressed maybe, but I don't think scared. And I think that comes down to, at least when I'm flying, just preparation and expectations over the flight, being able to understand what's going on. I mean, we've all had those moments where you're like, oh, we have to avoid weather, but there's like weather all in front of you. And you're like, what is the least, path of least resistance?
Yeah.
You're going to have to go through some weather regardless. I think that's more stress.
I like what I hear.
Well, if you get rattled, and I think if you truly have a fear-filled experience, you've got to take a couple of days off. Like even high stress days, you've got to take a day to yourself and really wind it over in your head on why that happened, why it was so high stress. Were you unprepared? Did something catch you unawares? Or was something just really, really intense that you just haven't experienced before and nothing in the books could have prepared you for it? If that's the case, talk to someone about it.
That's good advice. I like that. Yeah. It comes down to that resilience that you were talking about earlier on.
Yep.
This is the one I'm keen to know. If you were given an expense-free opportunity to be endorsed on any airframe, what would it be and why?
Oh, that's such an easy question. SR-71 Blackbird. Absolutely.
Have you seen one?
Yes.
In real life?
Not in the flesh. Not in the flesh, where I'm planning a one day going to America to see one in the museum.
I have.
Oh, I've stood I'm so and jealous. Touched. You've touched one.
Oh, yeah. Hill Air Force Base in Utah.
No way.
Yeah. So my wife and I went over to Utah to visit friends. And I'd actually been talking to a mate of mine before I went, and he went, because he'd been over there, and he went, oh, you have to go up to Hill Air Force Base. And I'm like, why is that? He goes, there's a cool museum up there. And I was like, oh, yeah. And he goes, there's SR-71 up there. And I'm like, right, that's it. So we touched down. We'd flown up from Florida, touched down, got the car, went to the hotel, dropped the bags and drove to Hill Air Force Base. Like, that's what we did. And after that, I didn't care what happened. Whatever she wanted to do, we did.
Yeah, so I'll follow you now. I'm satisfied.
That's it.
Oh, you've actually seen one.
Yes.
So cool.
Very, very cool. Oh, there's one also, or there was, I don't think it's there anymore. There was one on an aircraft carrier in New York that they had stationed. Yep. They had a whole bunch of them on there. But I saw something the other day about that aircraft carrier being decommissioned, so they moved it somewhere else.
Yeah, I think reason I want to fly that, or if it was expense-free, I think the idea of being able to outpace literally anything everything in the sky except for a rocket is quite awesome. And being able to view the stars further up in the atmosphere, and I'm already very lucky when I fly at night in the 320, but in that at 70,000 feet, oh, you'd just be amazing.
It'd be almost like you're in space.
I think it's as close as you can get to space without being an astronaut. So,
last question. What advice would you give to someone who's just starting out in aviation, and what resources or support systems would you recommend they seek out?
That's also another good question. I'll elaborate on what I said before. What I also think is a good thing is start with the end in mind. And what I mean by that is have a clear understanding of where you actually want to be and what aviation is for you and what it will do. So my dad was a very clever person, and he said, you know, there's like Venn diagrams where things overlap, and you know, you can only pick two and you have different options. He's always, there's three things and you can only pick two. So one is your fleet and rank. One is how much money you make, and one is where you live.
Mm-hmm.
You can pick two. And that's realistically what aviation's about. You always have to sacrifice something to get the other things. And knowing that if you end up getting all three, you've won the lottery and you should not move company or anywhere, and you should stay there, because that is amazing. But knowing where you want to be, what lifestyle, what plane, what airline, because that will change your goals and how you get into aviation.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to go onto an airline, cadetship's 100% of the way. But if you want to go into RFDS, then you need to do what they do and fly into dirt strips at night, that sort of experience. So that to start with, have a goal in mind, specific goal. And then maybe talk to people who are at that goal. You know, if you want to be an airline pilot, talk to airline pilots and how they got into it and how they would recommend it now, because things change, you know. What was good 10 years ago may not be good now, but they would still have a better insight than not talking to them at all.
Mm-hmm.
And as always, discipline, self-development, understanding yourself, learning about yourself, and accepting that failure is part of the process and how you build yourself up after that.
I love that. You've mentioned that a few times, failure is part of the process.
Yeah, it has to be. It has to be. Something this high performing, if you don't fail, then you should probably just go be an astronaut, because it's not hard enough for you. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like it's one of those things that everyone has to have to, and when it fails, probably a really harsh word. It's probably more like not achieving, you know, not passing something the first time, but you pass it the second time. And I mean, we can call that a fail, but it just sounds so absolute and negative when we say that F word, right? Fail. But we shouldn't think of it that way. You just always got to think that, okay, clearly I didn't study enough, or I didn't do armchair flying enough, or I didn't talk to enough people about the process. How can I improve that to make sure that I do better next time? And the other part, support systems, resources, talk to everyone. We're super tight knit in aviation. If we don't know, we'll give you someone who will know. And we'll almost always give you our honest opinion. We don't really beat around the bush with things like that. If we think one way is the best way, we'll tell you. But everyone has a different opinion. But definitely just talk to people, learn to fly with people as well. Go to those study groups. You learn so much by chatting. It's good.
And that's a fairly common theme that I've been getting out of my guests over the episodes, is talk to people. You mentioned earlier on, and I've mentioned it in previous episodes, the whole the thing of imposter syndrome. And it's very easy to feel that way. However, you know, in talking to airline pilots such as yourself, in talking to corporate pilots, and talking to highly experienced and proficient aviation examiners, you're all saying the same thing, and that is just talk to us, talk to people.
Yep. Even about failures. That's where you actually get the good stuff, because when you open up about your failure, they'll be like, that's nothing, mate. I did this the other day, la, la, la. And you just, It's a bit like therapy, actually.
Yeah. And well, and we learn from each other at the end of the day.
Absolutely.
All part of being a human.
Yep.
That's some really, really great insight. And I love the various aspects you've talked about, and there's definitely being a recurring theme in our conversation today. And it's great to hear that from someone, with all due respect, so young, that's in such an important position every single day when you're in command of that passenger airliner.
Yep.
There's very few, relatively speaking, in the 8 billion people in the world, there's relatively few of you that get to do that. And so it's great to hear that from yourself. So thank you very much for sharing that.
You're welcome.
Huge thanks to Michaela for sharing her incredible journey with us. And it's only still underway. You've still got, geez, nearly 40 years.
Well, don't say that.
Depending on when you set a goal to retire.
That's right.
That's it. And certainly I hope that Michaela's story serves as a beacon of inspiration for aspiring aviators, reminding us all that anything is possible, especially breaking barriers. So thanks so much for Michaela. All the best, obviously, with Jetstar. It sounds like your heart is certainly there.
Passionately orange.
Excellent. Wonderful. And a beautiful uniform it is.
Yeah.
You have a good day. And whenever I fly Jetstar, I'll be listening to hear if
this happens. Please. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. And I'm sure the listeners will love it. Thanks so much. Join us next time for more fascinating discussions. Subscribe now on your favourite podcast platform. And if you'd like to help out, feel free to leave a review. That'll help spread the word. Alternatively, you can listen to the podcast on the High Fly Media YouTube channel. Music for the podcast is titled Dance With Me by Asher Lee, available at upbeat.io. The High Fly Media Podcast, uncovering the people and passion behind aviation, one story at a time.